Our first interview this morning is with Dennis Nguyen. Welcome to the council, Dennis. For the next 45 minutes, we hope to learn a little bit more about you and give you a chance to answer questions. We'd like to start that off with an opening statement. So for the next couple minutes, please.
Thank you, sir. First of all, I'd like to thank Chairman Duncanson and the members of the Regents Candidate Advisory Council for allowing me the opportunity to discuss my interest in serving on the University of Minnesota Board of Regents. At a critical juncture in our university's history, I'm offering myself as a candidate for the Board of Regents because I possess a unique set of skills that can contribute immensely to the mission of the university going forward. I intend to use my professional, educational, and personal experiences to benefit the university in the following four ways. First, leveraging my deep and varied experience on corporate, university, and nonprofit boards, I can approach the issue of board governance within the University of Minnesota Board of Regents from an authoritative point of view. Second, leveraging my career in investment banking and private equity, I intend to offer out-of-the-box strategic insights to resolve our university's funding issues, create additional revenue streams, find new business partners, and control administrative costs. Third, leveraging my international business background, I can assist in promoting and marketing the university in global forums and seek new partnerships with other centers of academic excellence throughout the world, and especially in Asia. And finally, recognizing that we as a state are only as strong as our weakest citizens, I plan to be an advocate and a role model for members of historically disenfranchised communities. In doing so, I hope to increase access to the university for such communities. I've lived the American dream. Although not born in the United States, I'm very fortunate to have grown up in this country from the age of five. It is safe to say that I would not be here today if it would not be for the superb higher education that I received in Southern California, Washington, D.C., Minneapolis, Minnesota, and, of course, Chicago, Illinois. The distinguished members of this council have now read my biography and will note the following. The son of working class Vietnamese. First, I'm the son of working class Vietnamese refugees. The father of four young children, ranging from the ages of 13 to 10 months. A scholar athlete in high school, where I played football, basketball, and baseball. Sorry, there was no ice hockey in Southern California. While serving as editor in chief of my high school newspaper. A fervent believer that higher education can promote social justice and social mobility. I was a scholarship student and graduate of the University of California, Irvine, earning a double BA in economics and Chinese literature. I was a scholarship student and a graduate of the Johns Hopkins University, earning a master's of arts in international studies. I was a scholarship student and graduate of the University of Minnesota Law School, earning a Juris Doctor, and finally a graduate of the University of Chicago Booth School of Business, earning an MBA in Executive Management. Fourth, I've been an international financier, possessing over 15 years of executive management and corporate board director experience, having lived and worked on the ground in the United States, the United Kingdom, China, Korea, Japan, Vietnam, Southeast Asia, and the Middle East. In the process, I've taken five companies public via initial public offerings, served on three public companies' corporate boards of directors, and six privately held companies' boards of directors. Fifth, I'm a passionate supporter of my alma mater, the University of Minnesota. I have been for the last 3.5 years a University of Minnesota Law School adjunct professor. I've been a member of the University of Minnesota Law School Board of Advisors and a member of the University of Minnesota President's Club. Sixth, an active member of various academic and nonprofit boards. I'm a member of the University of California Foundation Board of Trustees, where I endowed a School of Humanities scholarship in my name. I was a former member of the University of California Irvine Alumni Association Board of Directors, where I was awarded the highest alumni association's honor, the Lauds and Laurels Distinguished Alumnus Honor. Just joined the Minnesota Historical Society Governing Board, and finally, a member of the National Committee on U.S.-China Relations. So why is this my resume important to you, the members of the Regent Advisory Council? Well, I know that's a cliche, but the world is changing. Truly, with the advent of globalization, borders between nation-states are disappearing, making the world a much smaller place. That means the market for human talent and financial capital moves at a much swifter pace. In my business, we say capital flows to its most efficient use. Indeed, it does. Along with the changes occurring throughout the globe, we must adapt outdated business models at American universities, or we will just be left behind. Left behind in the race for government and private sector research funding, left behind in seeking out of corporate partnerships, left behind in the increasingly competitive marketplace for professors and students, and finally, left behind in contributing to the new Minnesota economy of the 21st century. I offer three main qualifications and skills to the University of Minnesota Board of Regents. First, I understand the role of boards and how they efficiently function. As a general rule, boards need to focus on governance while administrators focus on management. In other words, boards focus on setting long-term strategy and policies while management deal with the day-to-day operations of an organization. I have served as chairs of governance, nomination, and compensation committees of three public companies. I currently serve as chair of an audit committee of one privately held company seeking an IPO in 2013. I really do understand the importance of governance and how it directly affects the efficiency of running of an organization. In terms of potential conflicts with the rest of the university, if I were fortunate enough to be elected and honored to be elected regent, I would immediately tender my resignation to the University of Minnesota Law School Board of Advisors and notify the dean of the law school that I would accept I would not accept any adjunct law professorships during the period of my regentship. I currently am not and do not plan to teach at any school of the university for the foreseeable future. I'm fully committed to this position, and yes, I do understand that I'm a very busy man, as we all are. And I understand that the average that it will take an average of 40 hours per month in performing my regent duties. I can incorporate this time commitment for the following two reasons. One, I have full 100% control of my professional and personal schedule. So based on a well-planned board calendar schedule, I will prioritize the activities of the Board of Regents. Two, despite my constant travel, I've put in place a talented executives for New Asia Partners. Business in my profession is usually done on computers and via meetings. If I'm unable to attend a meeting in person, I could always attend a business meeting via conference call. My second qualification is, over the past 15 years, I've been a financier of innovative businesses, both here in the United States and, of course, internationally. My job as chairman of a private equity firm with a 10-year history deals with the following. We look at many, many potential investment opportunities over the course of a given year, most of which we don't invest in. Our core deal analysis rests on this simple question. Will the contemplated investment earn an attractive enough return on a risk-adjusted basis to warrant New Asia Partners committing valuable financial capital and human resources to it? As part of this analysis, we analyze a potential company's customer profile, regulatory and competition environment, industry growth, historical and projected company profit margins, management histories, and the capital market appetite for such a company on a 1 to 5 year time frame. It's safe to say that I look at the world through Excel. We deal with investors throughout the world, ranging from Hong Kong to Singapore to London to Dubai to Los Angeles to New York, Minneapolis, and yes, even Memphis, Tennessee. Of course, our investors have all different investment requirements. They all have the same goal, which is to earn outsized return on risk-adjusted capital. We also work with attorneys, auditors, consultants, regulators throughout the world. Safe to say, I've acquired some very thick skin as a result of dealing with so many different groups of professionals throughout the world. The key to being successful in business, and indeed in life, is this: follow laid out core principles, but always be ready to pragmatically solve problems. I intend to bring this mindset to my regentship. So what does this have anything to being regent? Well, we all have read the Wall Street Journal article on the University of Minnesota dated the 29th of December 2012. While one can argue over the facts and figures due to different vantage points, as President Kaler has done in his response, one cannot deny the main theme behind the criticism. And that is to say, American universities are becoming more costly to its main customers, the students. And the primary reason due to this this cost increase is a large, arguably inefficient bureaucracy. So much like any business I would run, I would tackle problems such as this by asking the following question: what is the product we want to put out? The customers in this example, of course, are the students. And so are they getting what they're paying for? What metrics should we be using answering this question? I believe a good starting point in this discussion is the strategic positioning report issued by President Brunix in September 2007. I believe we need to look at the following, but not limit to the following: student graduation rates. We're doing better than we were 10 years ago. We're still very low, hovering around 40-45%. Contrast this with my undergraduate university, where the four-year graduation rate stands at 65%. Tuition increases have slowed, but still now at $13,000, which is double where it was in the year 2000. A legitimate question that we need to ask is, are the students getting the bang for the buck that they're paying for? These are the types of metrics and questions that we need to synthesize on our board in our discussions with the administration. At the end of the day, if we don't produce a good product, our students will go elsewhere for their education. And finally, my third qualification for this job is I've lived a life full of international and cultural diversity. I am fully aware that we as a state need to reach out to other less advantaged communities. After all, we as a society are only as strong as our weakest link. I've lived the successful immigrant story. I know how to advocate with communities of color and groups with lower socioeconomic backgrounds. It is in my blood. Initially, in the course of my studies and work, I've possessed significant hands-on worldview experience beginning at the age of 5, and have lived a total of 9 countries. We need to grab this international trend by the horns and embrace the 21st century, or we will be left behind. The world out there is moving at a fast pace, and we need to be there. The University of Minnesota can start moving this direction, and has so. But no current regent today has the hands-on worldview perspective that I possess. New Asia Partners is building the Minnesota Asia Bridge. Historically, over the last 15 years, there's been professionals from New York and California that have worked on Asian private equity deals, and if the deals are done from the United States. I am bringing these deals to Minnesota. In other words, we now have Minnesota-based investors, bankers, lawyers, and auditors working on our deals. For example, the chairman of one of our investee companies, Guangyo Food, met Governor Mark Dayton on his trade delegation, which I was fortunate to be part of, in June of 2012. As it turns out, Guangyo Food is an agricultural-based product company selling instant noodles. The governor impressed the chairman so much so that he plans to build a potato factory in Minnesota after the company's IPO next year. This is just one part of my building the Minnesota to Asia Bridge. So with that, those are my opening remarks. I thank you again for allowing me this opportunity to have this discussion with you all, and I look forward to the next 40 minutes of questions.
Thank you. Harriet, do you have the first question?
Sure. Well, thank you for that robust opening statement. You've given us a lot of information, and I have about 8,000 questions for you. But I'll start with just one. Within the context of your global business experience, can you talk to us a little bit about a circumstance where you believe you've been able to influence a course of action where you might not have been in charge, but the result has had broad benefit within the state of Minnesota, a specific example?
Great example is we, so in my industry, 2008 was the end of the world. It really was the end of the world for me. I retired, and I retired to Minnesota. Bought a house here at Lake of the Isles, uptown Minneapolis, and really started doing the teaching thing and writing my history book. And 2010, 2011, we started meeting up with investors here in Minnesota. And so, at that time I knew I wanted to build this Minnesota to Asia bridge. And so we met with some investors in downtown Minneapolis, principally Northland Securities, which is a local Minnesota investment bank, and New Asia Partners led a round into an Indonesian mining company. Now, if I wasn't here and New Asia Partners was not leading that investment, it's safe to say that that our group of Minnesota-based investors would have not had the access to invest in such a deal. And as it turns out, it's been a pretty good-sized deal for us, nice-sized return for us. Now, the capital markets are not where they were in 2004, 5, and 6, but I think they're rebounding, and that's the first of the tangible transactions that New Asia Partners has done and has a direct effect here in Minnesota. We've had lawyers at Fager & Benson, Dorsey & Whitney, auditors at Baker Tilly, and, of course, bankers at Northland Securities and Piper Jaffray working on our deals.
Thank you.
George?
Chairman, Mr. Nguyen, that was something to listen to. You got a background that I thought was... You're a privilege to run in the state for a region. But in the beginning, you said one of the things that you would do would be to try to control administrative costs. And later, I think you answered that, how you would do it, and I tried to write down. But now my question is, what do you see your role as a regent to be in relationship to the president of the university?
That's an excellent question, sir. I think the Board of Regents is very similar to other boards, whether it be in the corporate world, academic world, or nonprofit world, is that we set policy, we set strategy, we have discussions with the president of the university on where we should prioritize the spending of money, where we should be getting additional revenue streams in. But at the end of the day, the president of the university is the primary spokesperson for the university, is the manager of the university, and we need to, with our governance model, endow him with such responsibilities. And so I view it as almost a board of directors and CEO model, and where he implements the long-term strategy of the board, but at the end of the day, has the final say on implementing such strategies.
David?
Thank you. Thank you for your opening statement. Your accomplishments are, I think, well regarded by this group. I want to address something in the responses to written questions that you submitted. Ms. Nguyen, you had indicated that one of your questions is whether students are getting the best bang for the buck here at the university, and administrative costs would be one of those things to address immediately. In your written responses, though, you have made some remarks about the need to have fee increases for graduate students, especially in the professional schools, removal of tuition reciprocity agreements with neighboring states, fee increases for foreign students matriculating at the university. These are things, of course, that focus on now the issue of tuition. I don't want to put you on the spot, but I thought I should let you clarify or at least articulate a little bit more your philosophy between the balance between administrative costs and tuition.
That's an excellent question, sir. So I'm an economist. I believe the demand curve, as seen by different groups of customers are very different. And we call that the inelasticity or the elasticity of demand. So, for example, some groups of customers would be more willing to pay a greater price for the same product than other groups. And we need to differentiate that. So in my example, I'll give you an example. The University of California, Irvine, in-state tuition is roughly $13,000 a year. Out-of-state tuition is $36,000 a year. The University of Minnesota in-state tuition is roughly $13,000 a year. Out-of-state tuition is $18,000 a year. So if you compare an apples-to-apples contrast, you have essentially the University of California doubling what the University of Minnesota is charging for out-of-state students. Now, if we are a public institution catering to the residents of the state of Minnesota, I would have thought that the model should be something more like this. Low tuition for undergraduate in-state students, and because that's where the elasticity is much greater, because you're basically wanting to increase access to middle class and lower class students, communities of color. You want to bring more people into the university at the undergraduate level. Professional and graduate schools are an entirely different thing. Professional and graduate schools, the students that matriculate there generally have worked before, generally speaking, or have not, or even if they have not worked before, they're going straight from undergraduate, they've received their education, and they probably have some more means to pay for a more market-oriented cost of tuition. And so that's where I would differentiate that. Out-of-state students, one of the things I mentioned in my application is the University of Minnesota, currently we have 7% of our student, roughly about 6-7% of our student body are international students. One of the ways I think to increase the revenues to the state of the University of Minnesota as we're having this funding crisis is why not charge international students even a premium to what out-of-state students are being charged, something closer to what the University of California is charging. And so that's the model I would look at. A low tuition base, increasing access at the undergraduate level for residents of the state of Minnesota, but differentiate that at the international students level and also at the graduate and professional schools level.
Jennifer?
Yeah, I wanted you to expand a little bit more on your ideas of access to higher education for students of color and primarily students from Minnesota. I know a lot of times we put into the number of how many students of color go to the U with the international numbers. But if you could talk to what you know about, especially any kind of experience you have or understanding with communities locally and access to higher education.
Well, if I can, Jennifer, I'd like to contrast it to what we do in California. And hopefully maybe that model could be something we can do in part here in Minnesota. California, at University of California, Irvine, what we do is we have what's called the Humanities Outreach Program, where we send humanities graduate students to teach volunteer to the cost of the high school, but the cost to the university, we pay to such students, where we help with increasing access at the K-12 level so that kids from K-12 get a better education and hopefully better test scores and better GPA to allow them to be more qualified students when they do apply to the University of California, and thereby increasing access. As you know, in the University of California, the top 12.5% of any high school graduating class has automatic application approval to get into the University of California. I think these are something to look at here in Minnesota, whether it be communities of color, rural communities. I think it's important to increase, especially in my business, where I meet so many different people from so many different walks of life. That is important to increase cultural, ethnic, diversity, socioeconomic diversity of the university. And I think one of the ways to do that is really increase matriculation rates from communities of color by helping them with their K-12 education.
Sonia.
Mr. Nguyen. I want you to think of a time when you've been on perhaps a governing board. You're a team member. You're not in charge. You're addressing a complex set of issues. What has been your role, and how were you able to determine a course of action for that group to take?
Is it a bad issue or a good issue that happened?
It's complex. there's a big diversity of opinion, and the group is unsettled. It needs a course of action.
Well, this is a great example. Well, the thing with the corporate world, it's the defining decision at the end of the day is how much money is everyone going to make. So it's a little different from academic boards and nonprofit boards, right? So I want to differentiate that first. So I'll give you a great example. In September 2007, one of my companies that I invested in was a company called China Huaying, and it essentially was the Best Buy of China. It's a much smaller scale, but, you know, we had Best Buy look at it to try to buy it and all that. But what happened is we decided to go for initial public offering on the London stock market, London Stock Exchange. And so generally with these IPOs, what we do is we have institutional roadshows to meet up with institutional investors. It's generally a week to 2 weeks, and you have 8 to 10 meetings a day, meeting up with one-on-one with investors to hopefully get them to buy your stock at the end of the day. And I remember that like it was yesterday. We completed 2 days of meetings, and, you know, I was in London. I was really tired because you go literally from 8 to 8, and you're tired. I mean, you're really tired. So I get home. I get to the hotel. I open the door, and there's a fax sitting on the bottom of my floor. And I thought to myself, well, what is this? So I looked at it. And what it was, of course, it was a unsolicited offer from a private equity investor wanting to buy a significant proportion of the company. But it turns out the percentage that they wanted to buy almost equaled what we were selling to IPO investors at a valuation higher than what the IPO investors were selling at. Now, the chairman of the company was a Chinese man. His entire dream all along has been to be chairman of a publicly listed company. Okay, so I received this, and of course, what we did, of course, is I immediately notified the board. I served as vice chairman of the board then. And that night, we convened a meeting of the board of directors with people from the United States. Of course, me and him in England at that time, and of course, people from China. And, you know, since we as the private equity investors, we controlled the board, we said, well, you know, we should sell because it's more money. And of course, the chairman was like, no. I want to do an IPO because that's what I want to do, mm-hmm. right? And we were looking at our pocketbooks. Well, no, we want to sell because we're going to make more money. And so it went back and forth. And that went on for a good 2 days and back and forth. And finally, so we ended the roadshow, and we got back to China, and then we had another board meeting. And, of course, in the interim, on the plane from London to Shanghai, it's a long, long time, of course, I sat with them and said, what do you want to do? I said, I want to be chairman of this public company. I said, well, here's the story. We're at the tail end of a bull run, of a five-year bull run. And I don't know if you know, but the United States, there's something that's going to happen. I kind of knew back then. And I said, look, if you list right now, your shares, your stock price, after you list, is going to plummet because 2008 is going to come and it's going to be bad. Why don't you do this? Take some money off the table, and wait for a little bit longer when the markets become more stable, and then we could list. And he thought about it on that plane ride. It was a long, you know. Of course, I was like, I want my check, right? We stepped off the airplane, and he agreed.
And I think now that's one very small example. I think what it turns out is, and you can apply this to many different situations, is what's good for the overall good. He could have went straight to IPO, and he would have, whatever happened would happen. But at that time, we didn't know. But he did know that he would have upset his partners, us, and other people. And that's probably not a good thing. We could have went straight because we controlled the board and pushed through the private equity sale. And that would have been good for us, but would have ruined that relationship with him. So I think a lot of these times it's looking at your personal relationships. It's looking at what's good for the institution and working towards a greater good. And I think in our country today, I'm talking the United States of America, we're lacking that. We got both sides of the aisle essentially talking past each other, not looking for the greater good. And I think with regards to boards, and of course the University of Minnesota Board of Regents in the last year has seen some, interesting events happen with regents resigning and that sort of thing. I think those are the things that we need to think about when we make such decisions.
Thank you.
Margaret?
Your question relates, or my question relates to IPOs not in the public sector, but in higher education. What advice would you have for the University of Minnesota that had one grand victory with the AIDS vaccine and brought in nearly $300 million to the university, but it hasn't had a long stretch of IPOs related to research? What have you seen happen? How could you help with that issue at the University of Minnesota?
The issue of research funding?
Yeah, no, commercializing intellectual property at a University of Minnesota. It's a different type of IPO.
Look, I think we are entering a period of, Ms. Carlson, but the law school in 2013, on a net basis, we received zero funding from the Central University.
Right.
Now, of course, we're going to pay, whatever we have to pay in terms of electricity and all that. But on a net basis, it's now zero funding. So what does that mean? That means that we are essentially not getting any more state funding. We're now financed by three things. Tuition, and it's getting higher and higher and higher. Philanthropy through donors, high net worth donors, and of course corporate partnerships. Now, the law school, what we're doing is a mini IPO, not the IPO, the AIDS scale, but a mini IPO. We've set up a corporate institute. When this corporate institute is funded completely by sponsorships from companies, I think we should replicate that throughout the university, and I'm sure we have in certain quarters. One of the things I would look at is, I was reading these newspapers with the Wall Street Journal and the Star Tribune the last 10 days on it. It's one of these professors. He had this parking reimbursement and had to go through various levels to get his parking reimbursement. And the other day it was $13 parking reimbursement. It cost $71 to get it. Right. To get it paid back, this $13. I think we need to really level the approval process of setting up potential ventures with corporates. So what am I saying? In the case of the AIDS vaccine or other biotech home run IPOs, as you allude to, why not set up a institute or a department or an office that reports directly to the president of the university, where it's essentially your office of strategic development, or in the corporate world, where we identify, look, the School of Humanities or the School of Biological Sciences or the School of whatever. We have this great partner that's coming in, and this company will fund 80, 90, 100% of this partnership. And in return for whatever intellectual property that goes out, we would then earn a percentage of those royalties. I think that's a great model because it allows companies to work in collaboration with the university. We do that at the University of California, Irvine, where companies such as Advanced Medical Optics have set up a venture with the School of Engineering, where you know they redesign you know glasses, you know, eyeglasses, and all that, and they put up 100% of the money. And anything that we sell in the marketplace, University of California earns a royalty. Now, of course, it's a smaller royalty, percentage of royalty, than what the corporate would earn, but nevertheless, it adds a lot of value to the university. And I think that's something the University of Minnesota should call.
Mr. New, we're down to about 7 minutes left. We have a couple of questions left. Lois?
Mine is along the lines of Margaret Carlson's question. It deals with the economy. University of Minnesota's singular land-grant economic driver of the state of Minnesota. Talk with us a little bit, if you would, please, about economic driver of the state of Minnesota in all of its geography, all of its regions, and in the multiple of ways beyond the final step of a commercialization that is an IPO. How can the university be an enhanced economic engine for all of the state?
I'm a big believer in public-private partnerships. I think that's how this country was built, actually. You know, you have a lot of people these days talking about privatized this, and a lot of people on the other side talking about the extreme. And I always tell people on both sides of the aisle, well, let's look at what President Eisenhower did in the 50s in creating and developing the interstate highway system. I think there's something within the University of Minnesota where, you know, where our mission, of course, is research, teaching, and outreach. Through outreach, through extension, historically it's been setting up agricultural center stations throughout the state and having people that aren't in the Twin Cities deal with the University of Minnesota. Now, to directly answer your question in terms of economic development, a great way, as Ms. Carlson said, was to incubate, for lack of a better word, these intellectual properties that can come out. There's other ways to do it. And if you look at the various studies that in any area that the University of Minnesota is in, whether it's Rochester, Morris, Duluth, Twin Cities, taxes in that region, the tax base grows up. That's number one. Two, jobs are being created. Not jobs of the government variety, but people that actually are affiliated with the university maybe go out and create private sector jobs. I think those are the models that we would look at. I'm given who I am. I liked her question, and I think that's something that we really should really pursue. We're a large research university. There's a lot of human talent in this school, and we need to leverage that.
Jerry?
I thought I had really good questions. I think Margaret.
Yes, sorry. Margaret did a number on it. Didn't? Yes, yes.
Mine's a little more specific. You know, you mentioned in your opening statement about in the news articles about the university's academic health center, and you know, the university being a more than $3 billion enterprise, I've seen estimates that about a third of that are related to the academic health center. And some things you suggested, such as increasing professional school tuition and even higher increases for non-residents. But going back a step to that, you know, this is an academic health center that in years past has been rated very highly in the entire world. Now we're seeing some reports that maybe that isn't quite the case. What do you suggest as a region that you can do about this to bring this at least back to the status of 25 years ago and maybe increase it, as was the goal of former presidents of the university as well as deans of the medical school?
So are you directly asking in regards to the Fairview University Minnesota Medical
Center? The entire academic health center.
Okay.
Yeah.
I know a few things well, but that's one of the issues that I would definitely have to study. At this point in time, sir, I probably could not give you an educated, intelligent answer on what we should do with the medical school and the academic health center. But what I would suggest, though, is this, as a general answer, is that what is the intent of where we're going to intend to take the medical school and the academic health center? At UC Irvine, it's called the Douglas Hospital, by the way. We wanted to make it the number one hospital and medical center in Orange County, California. So how did we do that? We went out and got initial $22 million in funding for that hospital to build that into something that rival the USC and UCLA medical centers in Los Angeles. If that is something that we are looking at, are we trying to train our doctors at this hospital? These are questions that currently at Fairview, we have 70% of our medical students being trained there. If that is the case, are they going to be working there afterwards, after their residency? So those are the questions I would ask. And hopefully that's sufficient for today for your questions, sir.
Joanne, one last question.
Mr. Nguyen, if you're selected as regent, which committees would you like to serve on and why?
I think the most value I could add is probably the audit committee. I love going through the little spreadsheets and identifying. us Asians, we're really good at numbers and all that. In terms of value, I would that's where I think I could add, and I have the most experience there. There are, of course, the other committees. But I think audit committee is something I would enjoy serving on.
Well, we've reached the end of our allotted time here. You have a follow up? Okay, I'm sorry. Mr. Nguyen, would you please give us a closing statement, and I'll ask you to keep it brief if you can.
First, I'd like to thank the members of the council for allowing me this opportunity to meet and discuss my intentions of being elected as regent. I have, as part of this process, met up with a number of individuals, and it's kind of like the listening tour, right? It's kind of why is this important? Why is regent important to me? Well, it's important to me because we need to position the university for the next century. I can offer some alternative views on where we're at. I would not, this is my second time living in Minnesota. First time was 3 years as a law student. It's my second time, 4 years. I don't have too many institutional baggage that would hold me down in terms of asking the pertinent questions that need to be asked, whether it be within the board, whether it be to the administration, whether it be to the public in general. My loyalty is to the university. People ask me, what's this Vietnamese guy doing in the state of Minnesota? And the direct answer is, in 1995, I received a full-ride scholarship to attend the University of Minnesota Law School. I will be forever indebted to the state of Minnesota for that. I feel like over the last 15 years of my life, I have done a number of things, and I like to contribute my talents and experiences to the board, and as a result, hopefully increase the efficiency of the running of the university. And with that, I thank you, everybody, for this opportunity on a very cold January day.
Thank you. Thank you.